Okay, so next week is Dead Weeks, and I'm going to devote Wednesday and Friday of next week just to prepare you for the final exam. And in the between now and next Wednesday, though, we have one last topic to consider, and that's the notion of orthogonal decompositions. So I'm going to introduce this today. It starts off pretty easy, where I just speak about how I take a vector and I break it down into a part that's running in one direction and another part that's running perpendicular to it. And then the idea is going to be to extend that geometric picture, where instead of thinking about projection onto another vector, we actually project onto a subspace. And then if we have time, we'll do some examples of this. But the start of this lecture is going to be a lot easier than what we've considered thus far. But as soon as I begin to talk about orthogonal projections onto subspaces, there the apparatus we've developed over the course of the semester is going to come into play. So let me start just introducing you to the problem. Suppose I have two vectors in a plane. Well, let's see if I can get that picture fully on screen. All right, so two vectors in a plane. The idea that we're going to examine today is going to be a generalization of this problem, wherein, given my two vectors, how can I decompose one of them as a sum of two vectors? One part that's running parallel to a given direction, B, and another part that's running perpendicular to that direction. So this all takes place in a plane, but so we can use plane geometry to answer this question. But what you see from the diagram and our method of adding vectors geometrically is what we're trying to do is decompose A into a sum of two vectors. And of course, if you follow the rules for adding vectors geometrically, this resultant vector here is the sum of this vector plus this vector. So you place the tail of the second term at the tip of the first term, and then you get that vector sum. So in this situation, we have some terminology. We say that this decomposition, splitting A up into two parts, is an orthogonal decomposition. We call A subscript B, this vector here. That's the vector that's the part of A that's running in the direction of B. The other component, A perpendicular, is the component of A that's perpendicular to B. And other terminology that one sometimes apply for this situation is they call that part of A that's running in the direction of B. We call that the projection of the vector A onto the vector B, because if you imagine a flashlight held off a long distance away, shining down directly onto the vector B, then effectively, this part of B is a part of A it's the shadow of the vector A in the direction of B. So we often call these orthogonal projections, in the sense that when we project directly down perpendicular to B, effectively, the component that we're seeking here, part of A that's parallel to B, is exactly the shadow of A on the vector B. Hence, the nomenclature orthogonal projection. Okay, so let's look at this situation and see what it. Here I've just drawn pictures, but how would we actually compute these things using linear algebra? How would we have given a ordered list of numbers, or two ordered lists of numbers, how would I find the corresponding vectors A subscript B, the part of A that's running parallel to B, and the part that's running perpendicular to B? Well, from high school geometry, where you have a right triangle with an angle theta, then the adjacent side, you take the length of the hypotenuse. And the length of the adjacent side is the length of the hypotenuse times the cosine of the angle in between. And the opposite side is, of course, the length of the hypotenuse times the sine of the angle. And so while I don't have this guy yet as a vector, I can look at the geometry of this situation and see that the length of this projection, since it's the adjacent side of a triangle with angle theta, it's just going to be the length of that hypotenuse, which is the length of the original vector A times the cosine of the angle. And the perpendicular part is, well, similar, except we use the sine because it's the opposite side. All right, now I'm still working sort of geometrically, but now we'll translate into thinking of vectors as ordered lists of numbers. One utility of the dot product, even when applied to n-dimensional vectors, is it allows us to determine lengths and angles inside a vector space that is not necessarily three-dimensional space or two-dimensional space. We can find lengths and angles in a vector space of arbitrary dimension n. And in fact, we have this formula that links dot products carried out in Rn with this geometric information. The dot product of an n-dimensional vector with another n-dimensional vector is going to be the length of the first vector, the length of the second vector, still times the cosine of the angle in between. This formula, actually, you prove it is you start off working in an n-dimensional space, but then you restrict attention to the plane that these two vectors generate. Now you're working in a plane, and you can use the two-dimensional formula for the dot product. All right, so what's on the right-hand side here? I've expressed them geometrically, but they're all computable in terms of the dot products. So the length of a vector is just the square root of the dot product with itself. And the angle, well, you can take that formula and you can solve for the angle. What you're going to get is cosine of the angle between two vectors is just going to equal the dot product divided by the corresponding lengths. And then purely in terms of the dot product of two ordered lists of numbers, we can see that this is, I'll still keep the dot product notation, but then this is divided by the square root of A dotted with A and the square root of B dotted with B. So in terms of this dot product that's defined on n-dimensional vectors, we can still calculate lengths and angles. And all we have to do is compute these sort of dot products, where we just sum the pairwise products of each of the components of the vectors A and B. Okay, so this situation then, calculationally, reduces this. The length of this vector here is the length of the hypotenuse times the cosine of the angle in between. But then we can use dot products to compute both those guys, and it you can see how that works out. I'm substituting for cosine theta AB using the right-hand side there. And now I've got an expression for this length that I can compute purely in terms of the dot products of ordered lists of numbers. I want more than just the length of this vector, though. I want to get its direction as well. But in some sense, we already know the direction. The length of this vector in the direction of B is, of course, heading in the direction of B. So let's represent that direction, not by B itself, but by a unit vector, a vector of length 1 that's going in the same direction as B. The way you get that is you take your original vector, you divide by its length. That effectively produces a vector in the same direction, but whose length is equal to 1. All right, so the way I'm going to get this vector AB, I know it heads in this direction, and I know its length. This direction is given by a unit vector. So in fact, this vector is going to have, this part has length 1. So this vector is going to have the same length as the length of B, and it's heading in the right direction as well. So in fact, this is the vector. This vector A subscript B is given by this. And now we'll just fill in our result. So let's see. The length of this component we saw was previous slide. The length of that component is AB. Its length was determined to be, A dotted with B divided by the magnitude or the length of B. And then, so I'll substitute in there. And then for the unit vector in the B direction, I'll substitute B divided by the magnitude of B. Then I can consolidate the denominator a little bit better, but then that length squared is just the dot product of B with itself. And so now I've got a nicer closed formula that produces exactly this vector. To get that vector, I take the dot product of A with B, I divide by the length of B squared, and I multiply by the direction of B. All right, so what this geometry combined with our dot product in Rn does is it gives us a nice closed formula for each component of this orthogonal decomposition. What I've just shown you is that the part that's running parallel to B is calculable as this, dot product of A with B divided by dot product of B with itself times the vector B. To get the perpendicular component, well, all I have to do is I've computed AB, take AB to the opposite side, and then you get an expression for the perpendicular component as well. So this is how the orthogonal decomposition of a vector A, let's say this vector A lives not necessarily in the plane or in a three-dimensional space, an arbitrary vector in an n-dimensional space, and so the orthogonal decomposition with respect to another vector, we'll simply call it a direction B inside Rn. So now we can do that same orthogonal decomposition. We can do it in an n-dimensional space, and we'll use the dot product, but not the one where A dot B is equal to the length of A times length of B times the cosine of theta. Rather, what we're using is the dot product where we take each component of A, multiply it by the corresponding component of B, and add things up. All right, so let's do an example. Here's two vectors. They're in three-dimensional space. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to explicitly compute the decomposition of A into a part that's running parallel to this vector and a part that's perpendicular to that vector. We'll use the formula we just derived. So we compute this vector. So you take two dot products in the numerator and in the denominator, and then you use that as a scalar factor that multiplies the vector B. And what you end up with in this example is a vector 1/2 minus 1/2 0. And then to get the other component of the decomposition of A with respect to the direction of B, all you do is you subtract the part that's running parallel to B, you subtract it from A, and that leaves you with the other perpendicular component. All right, so there explicitly is the computation of the orthogonal decomposition of a given vector A with respect to a particular direction. All right, now that's all pretty simple, and everything was pulled back to simple plane geometry. And our two different versions of the dot product. The dot product A dot B can be thought of, let's say, as A1 B1 plus AN BN. So that's thinking about it where vectors are ordered list of numbers. Or we had, it's the length of A times the length of B times the cosine of the angle between A and B. And this is when we think of vectors as directed line segments. So more geometrically. And it was by working with these two interpretations of the dot product that we actually achieved the orthogonal decomposition. Okay, so the next task is to generalize these ideas to a different situation. Now, instead of, we'll look at a vector B, but instead of looking at its projection along a particular vector, we're going to look at its projection on a particular subspace. So I've drawn this picture in three dimensions, but you're to imagine it in being an n-dimensional situation where you have a given vector and a subspace of Rn. So that's going to be some hyperplane that passes through the origin. And what I'm going to want to do is take a given vector, find a part of the vector V that lives inside that subspace, and then find another component to V that's running perpendicular to the subspace. And the idea is now to find a decomposition of the vector V with respect to the subspace. What we're going to want to do is represent V as a part that lives in the subspace plus a part that's somehow perpendicular to that subspace. And then that's going to be what we call the orthogonal decomposition of a vector B with respect to a subspace. Let me give you an application of this sort of stuff. Suppose you have an airfoil or something like this, and you have an airstream hitting that airfoil. What's relevant, the force that's actually exerted on this airfoil, is going to depend not on this direction per se, rather the force that's exerted on this surface here is going to be a normal force. And so if you have a force acting on an airfoil, what you'd want to do is throw away the part that's running parallel. The actual force on the surface is the normal force. And so you want to achieve an orthogonal decomposition. Here I'm just drawing sort of the tangent surface to an airfoil. You want to calculate the force that this thing actually receives is going to be the perpendicular, the component of the force that's actually perpendicular to that surface. But these notions are going to have applications beyond this simple sort of aerodynamical problem. We're treating it in general, where we simply have a subspace of an n-dimensional vector space, and what we want to do is decompose a vector so that we have a part that lies in the subspace and identify the part that's running perpendicular to that subspace. So what I'm going to show you is that, in fact, for any vector, once you have a subspace, then you can always break any vector inside Rn up into two pieces, one that lies in the subspace and one that lies perpendicular to that subspace. We'll call, in analogy with the vector case, we'll call this the orthogonal projection of your given vector onto W, and B is going to be the perpendicular component. Okay, so let me show you how we do it. What I'm going to do first is, here's the subspace we're interested in. Keep my picture up. Yeah. here's our three-dimensional space. Maybe we have a hyperplane city in it, and then we have a vector. A vector also in your three. Oh, shoot. Nope. No point. There we go. All right, you get an assist. Okay, so now what I'm going to do, sorry, I was in the middle of a picture, I guess. Here we have a subspace W. That's this flat sheet embedded in three space. We have an additional vector V. And what we're trying to do is think of shining a light perpendicular to this this flat surface. And we're trying to calculate the shadow of the vector on this flat surface, on this hyperplane. So what I'm going to do to solve this problem is I'm going to introduce a different subspace. I'll call it W superscript perpendicular. And what it is, it's going to consist of all the vectors inside Rn that are perpendicular to every vector inside our subspace. So what I'm going to do is this perpendicular piece is supposed to be perpendicular to W. Now, what that really means is it's not perpendicular to the individual points in W, but rather for any line inside W, it should be perpendicular to those. So, so what I'll do is simply define a new subspace by demanding that it consists of n-dimensional vectors that are perpendicular to every vector that lives inside the subspace. All right, so if my subspace has a basis, I'm looking for vectors that are perpendicular to every vector inside W. So it's got to be perpendicular to every vector that's in W. Well, here's a typical way of writing a vector inside your subspace. You just expand it in terms of its components. Remember what a basis is. It's a set of vectors that generates the entire subspace and also has the property that vectors are linearly independent so that these coefficients are unique. But if you have a basis, then you can always expand a vector with respect to that basis. And what I'm going to do then is to, in order to find vectors that are perpendicular to every vector inside W, it suffices to make sure V is perpendicular to expansions of this sort. And then we can impose this condition by, instead of demanding that V is perpendicular to every vector in W, it will suffice just to be perpendicular to these basis vectors. Because if V is perpendicular, well, here's the condition I want. V is perpendicular to every vector inside W. There's an infinite number of vectors inside W, so that's not going to be possible to check directly. However, if V is perpendicular to just these K basis vectors, then there's only K conditions that we have to check. And so that's what we'll impose. We'll demand, in order to find vectors that are perpendicular to every vector in W, what we'll do is look for vectors that are perpendicular to each of the basis vectors for W. And then that leads to a simple linear system. Here's the equation. B1 through BK are the vectors that generate my subspace. I'm looking for vectors that are perpendicular to every vector in W, and so they should in particular be perpendicular to each of the basis vectors. And then when I set up this equation, basis vector by basis vector, and write it as a vector equation, you see that effectively we have a linear system. Here the zero vector, these dot products, I could get them via a matrix product. I take the first row of this matrix, I take a dot product with this first column, that gives me the first component of this matrix product is exactly this B1 dot B1. And so the condition I'm imposing on B that is perpendicular to every basis vector is a nice homogeneous linear system. It has the form of a coefficient matrix times a variable is equal to the zero vector. And we know how to solve such systems. What you do is you look at the coefficient matrix, you row reduce it to reducer echelon form. Effectively, what we need to do is calculate the null space of that matrix. But notice we're doing one thing a little bit different than what we normally do. Normally, when I use vectors to form a matrix, I normally use them as columns. In this particular instance, though, what we're trying to do is replicate these individual equations, but in the context of a linear system. And so it just so happens that in order to reproduce this, the proper thing to do is to take the coefficient matrix using the basis vectors as rows, not columns. All right, but then that's how we do it. And then what's going to happen is that every vector in the null space of this coefficient matrix is going to be a solution of this matrix equation, this homogeneous linear system. And so that's what we do. Now, this matrix, this subspace W perpendicular that consists of all vectors in Rn that are perpendicular to every vector inside my given subspace, the way I can calculate that is take my basis vectors for W, write them as the rows of the matrix, and then calculate the null space of that matrix. All right, so we'll call this subspace the orthogonal complement to W inside Rn. It's not W itself. What we do is we take the vectors that generate W and use them as row vectors and then calculate a basis for the solution set of a linear system of that form. All right, so let me call that matrix A subscript W. So I just use these subscripts just to remind you that I'm creating a set of vectors that is perpendicular to every vector in W, but my calculation also can require a choice of basis for that subspace. All right, now, I'm not actually going to solve this explicitly, but I am going to use some facts that we know about coefficient matrices. First of all, each of these basis vectors, well, W is a subspace of Rn. And so its basis vectors, the subspace itself may only be k-dimensional, but it's exhibited as a k-dimensional subspace of Rn. So these basis vectors, they're not k-dimensional vectors. They're still n-dimensional vectors. It's just that by taking linear combinations of these guys, I get all these guys. All right, so we look at this matrix. We definitely have k rows, one for each basis vector for W, but we're going to have n columns. And so this coefficient matrix, the coefficient matrix of a linear system that we're trying to solve, it's going to have exactly n columns. But let's divide the columns of this matrix up into two families. You could take this matrix and you can row reduce it to row echelon form. Once you've done that, there'll be columns that have pivots and columns that don't have pivots. The columns that have pivots, well, they give you a basis for the column space, or equivalently, they give you a basis for the row space. The number of them is going to be the dimension of the row space or the dimension of the column space. That common dimension is called the rank of A. And then you have the dimension of the null space. You get as many basis vectors here as you have columns with pivots in a row echelon form of this matrix. This here is equal to the number of free parameters you get when you solve the corresponding linear system. It's going to be equal to the number of columns without pivots. And so the rank of this matrix? Well, we already know what that is. It's the number of linearly independent row vectors. It's the number of linearly independent vectors it takes to generate the row space. Well, because these are basis vectors, they're known to be linearly independent. And so these guys are exactly a basis for the row space. And so since we have a basis, we count the number of basis vectors, that gives us dimension of the row space or the rank of the corresponding matrix. So if as many basis vectors as we have, that's going to give us the rank of that matrix. And then we have the dimension of the null space. To add it, this is the space that we're interested in. That null space here is exactly that orthogonal complement of the original subspace W. This null space is exactly all the vectors inside Rn that are perpendicular to every vector in the subspace W. And what I've shown you with this little calculation is that the dimension of that null space is going to be exactly n minus k. Just move this to the opposite side. And then you see that the dimension of the null space, it has to be the total number of columns you have here, n minus the number of rows you have. All right, so we know how to calculate null spaces. We take the matrix, we row reduce, we reduce row echelon form, we convert back to equations, separating free parameters from fixed parameters, and we expand in terms of the free variables, and we can not only write down the solution, we can also find a basis for this space. But what this little calculation tells us, though, is that the number of free parameters or the number of basis vectors we're going to have for this null space is going to be n minus k. So let me suppose that I've solved the linear system. Let me put full glory in here. A, W, C. So W perpendicular is the solution set of this linear system. And what I argue here is that this solution set is n minus k dimensional. And so, because every subspace has a basis, what I know is that once I solve this linear system explicitly, there's going to be exactly n minus k basis vectors. Instead of labeling them from 1 up to n minus k, I'm going to start my counting for this basis starting off at k plus 1 and going up to n. So the total number of vectors in this list here is still going to be n minus k because I start my counting at k plus 1 rather than at 1. The reason for doing that is I can take the basis for W and I could adjoin to that the basis for this perpendicular subspace. So here, sorry, I don't want to write on the wall here. B1 through BK is a given basis for our given subspace. And then the additional vectors, BK plus 1 to BN, that's how we're denoting the basis for the solution set of AWB equals 0. And that solution set is exactly our perpendicular subspace. What I'm now going to show you is that, in fact, when I take these vectors and I join them to the original basis for W, that, in fact, I get a basis for the entire vector space in which everything lives, Rn. The reason why that's true is, it's based on the fact that if you have and linearly independent vectors in an n-dimensional space, you have a basis for that space. You know, if you have n linearly independent vectors, you can reach every point in your n-dimensional space. If the only reason why the span of a given list of vectors, if you're working in an n-dimensional space, you have n independent directions to fill out that space. And that's why these vectors would generate all of Rn so long as we knew they're linearly independent and they're truly independent directions. If some of those vectors were parallel, then I wouldn't have enough directions to fill out the entire space. So what I want to show is that if I take the original basis and the a basis for the solution set for this perpendicular, or the a basis for this perpendicular complement, by combining those two bases together, I get a basis for Rn. Now, I've got n independent n vectors inside Rn. If I can show that they're linearly independent, then I know I actually have a basis. And so all we have to do is check to make sure that the vectors b1 through bn, that entire list of vectors, that they're linearly independent. So let's suppose we had a dependence relation. There was a linear combination of these vectors that produces a zero vector. If I can do that without taking all these coefficients separately equal to zero, then they would not be linearly independent. But if the only way I can satisfy this equation is by separately setting c1 is equal to zero, c2 is equal to zero, all the way up to cn is equal to zero, then I've shown that they're linearly independent. And so there'll be a basis for the entire vector space. All right, so what I'll do is I'll take this condition and I'll split it right between the basis vectors coming from W and the basis vectors coming from the perpendicular to W. I'll just take these last n minus k terms and I'll move them over to the right-hand side of the equation. All right, so let's take these vectors, c1, b1, up to ck, bk. That's a linear combination of a basis for W. So the vector on the right-hand side is going to be a vector that lives inside the subspace W. On the left-hand side, we have a linear combination of basis vectors for W perpendicular. And so the right-hand side is going to be a vector that lives inside W perpendicular. And then this condition, which is equivalent to this condition, becomes that this vector inside W has to equal the negative of this vector B2 that lives in W perpendicular. Let me keep that condition up. So we're checking for linear independence. That's why I set C1, B1, dot, 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 plus CK, BK, plus CK plus 1, BK plus 1, plus dot, 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 plus CN, BN. This is what I'm calling B1, and this is what I'm calling B2. This lives in the perpendicular subspace because it's in a linear combination of the basis vectors for that subspace, and this guy lives inside W. And what we've seen is that B1 has to equal the negative of B2. And now what I'll show you is that, in fact, this condition is going to imply that all the coefficients C1 through CK and CK plus 1 up to CN, they separately have to equal 0. When you do that is I take this equation and I take its dot product with B1. So I'll have B1 dotted with B1. It's going to equal B1 dotted with B2. The negative of that, because I have a negative sign here. All right, now, Remember that every vector inside the perpendicular subspace is perpendicular to every vector inside W. This guy lives inside W. This guy lives inside W. This guy lives inside the space of vectors that is perpendicular to every vector in W. So that's got to equal zero, because every vector in the perpendicular subspace is perpendicular to every vector in W. But then I have, on the right-hand side, I have the length of V1. It's dot product of V1 of itself. It's just going to produce the length squared. Its length squared is equal to zero. That means that V1 has to be the zero vector. All right, so in fact, if this equation holds, then in fact, the vector V1 has to be the zero vector. Well, this implies V1 is equal to the zero vector, and that in turn is going to apply because these vectors V1 through VK are basis vectors and linearly independent. So a linear combination of these vectors can only equal the zero vector when all the coefficients are equal to zero. So you're going to need C1 is equal to zero, C2 is equal to zero, up to CK has to equal zero. But the other consequence of that, I've deduced that B1 is equal to zero. Well, B2, if the dependence relation holds, it has to equal the negative of B1. And so B2 is also equal to zero. It's minus V1, so it's minus the zero vector, which is the zero vector. Again, the vector V2 is a linear combination of linearly independent vectors. If this linear combination equals zero, then all the coefficients have to equal zero. And so because V2 also has to equal the zero vector, and because it was constructed as a linear combination of linearly independent vectors, all those coefficients have to separately vanish. All right, and now I've got the statement that I want. The only way a linear combination of this basis for Rn, a basis that was constructed by first finding a basis for our given subspace W, a second basis that was found by using the basis vectors of W to form a coefficient matrix and then solving the corresponding linear system, that gave us some additional vectors. What the theorem says is that when I combine those two sets of vectors, I get a set of n linearly independent vectors inside Rn, and so a basis for Rn. And what I've shown, arguing it's somewhat lengthily, is that this equation implies that these two vectors live in different subspaces. So V1 is perpendicular to V2, and then taking dot product of V1 with itself has to equal, taking dot product of both sides with V1, we get the length of V1 squared has to equal zero. So V1 is the zero vector. But then the same equation, if this is the zero vector, implies that this is the zero vector. These two vectors cannot equal zero unless all these coefficients are equal to zero, because the basis vectors we use to expand them are linearly independent. All right, so that's the argument. And now let me return to the original problem. All right, so what we have so far, and let me check the time here. Okay, 6 minutes. Okay, so the goal here is to decompose a vector V with respect to a subspace W. And I haven't done that yet, but we're pretty close to it right now. What I did, as I just completed a digression that told me that I can find a basis for Rn, that's this total basis here, by, first of all, finding a basis for the subspace W. So that's going to be these vectors B1 through B, BK. Then, once I find that basis for W, I use these vectors B1 through BK to find indirectly a basis for not W, but the set of vectors that's perpendicular to every vector in W. The way, what this subspace is, it's the null space of the matrix I get using my given basis as row vectors, BK. All right, and then what we found is that the dimension of this null space is going to be n minus k dimensional. So we write bk plus 1 up to bk as a basis for that null space, or the perpendicular complement. The theorem then says that when I combine this set of vectors, my basis for W, with this set of vectors, which once we know the vectors B1, these vectors can be calculated by solving a linear system. We'll get a new set of vectors. When I join these together, I get a basis for the entire vector space Rn. And now I can show you precisely how we are going to carry out the decomposition with respect to a subspace. What we do is we've got this basis, B1 through BK, that's our basis for W, and then I'm adjoining to that the vectors B1, BK plus 1 up to BN. Those are basis for the perpendicular complement of W. And together, we get a basis for the entire vector space in which both these subspaces live. Because these guys are a basis for the entire vector space, every vector V inside Rn can be expressed as V equals some coefficient times the first basis vector, dot, 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 plus some coefficient times the last basis vector that lives in W. But then we have some additional term, CK plus 1 times BK plus 1. Now I'm working with the components along these directions. And the last one will be CN, BN. And the point is, I've got these guys. As soon as I group these guys differently, I'll get exactly the composition I want. These first K terms here, they're all linear combination of basis vectors for W. So let's call that part B subscript W, because this vector, as a linear combination of basis vectors for W, is going to live inside W. Meanwhile, these last n minus k terms, they're all multiplying basis vectors for the perpendicular subspace W subscript perp. And that, we'll call that vector B perp. And now I've got a decomposition of an arbitrary vector inside Rn into a piece that lives inside W plus a piece that's perpendicular to W. And so that's the desired orthogonal composition. We can now take any vector inside Rn and split it up into two components, a part that lives in a subspace and a part that's perpendicular to that subspace. Have I run out of time? I have. So what I'll do on Monday is I'll do explicit examples of this, and you'll see the full calculation. And then I think I'll talk a little bit about orthogonal bases. And then I think we're done with the material for the course, and we'll just concentrate on reviewing after that. Okay, so have a good weekend. Homework set 9 is going to be the last homework set I assign. Try to have that done by Monday so we can talk about any difficulties you have with finding eigenvectors or diagonalizing matrices. Yeah.
So there's a homework asking for the zero eigenvalue appears twice. So would the eigenvector also, the zero eigenvector also appear twice?
Not necessarily. So you can have you always have at least one eigenvector, one linearly independent eigenvector for every eigenvalue, but you could have more than one. So that's why we make a distinction between the algebraic multiplicities and the geometric multiplicities. Algebraic multiplicities just tell you how many factors, or how many times that root is repeated. But the geometric multiplicities, they can't be more than the algebraic multiplicities, but they could be less than that. So you could have, when you diagonalize, you could have two zero entries, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you have two linearly independent eigenvectors. Here's a simple example, 0, 1, 0, 0. So when you compute the characteristic polynomial of this, you're going to get, so PA of lambda is going to be the determinant of minus 0 minus lambda, 1, 0, 0 minus lambda. That's going to be lambda squared, just lambda squared. And so because the cross diagonal product is 0, so you're going to have only one root. And you think of this as lambda minus 0 squared. So the eigenvalue 0 has algebraic multiplicity 2. But as soon as you try to calculate the 0 eigenspace, what you're going to find is that, well, it's already in row echelon form. How many free parameters do we have? We only have one column without a pivot. So you know, you see that you can have at most one linearly independent eigenvalue, because the system that you have to solve, A minus lambda times I equals 0 to get the corresponding eigenspace, it only going to have one free parameter, so it's only going to be one dimensional. So I have two factors here, and so yeah, but I'm only getting a one dimensional solution set.
In the homework, you have to enter there's a total of 3 roots, and so 0 appears twice, and then there's another one.
Yeah. So you have at least two linearly independent eigenvectors. What can happen, though, is you could have two eigenvectors that are linearly independent from one another, so they point in different directions, but they have the same eigenvalue. Okay. That can happen. Yeah.
I have a question. If you could scroll
to
the previous slide. It is.
Let me just stop here for a second here. I'm going to stop the slide. And